This week on What's Going On with Earl Ingram, Dr. Kazim, speaking from Iran, offers a sobering perspective on the global crisis of war and the human toll it continues to take. He unpacks Iran's stance on conflict, regional pressure, and sovereignty, cutting through the headlines to explain how war shapes everyday life beyond the battlefield. This conversation challenges listeners to look past rhetoric and consider the real consequences of endless escalation. Follow us on civicmedia.us or wherever you find your podcast, and please remember to like, share, subscribe so you don't miss the conversation. Triumphantly. Morning and welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. I am thrilled this morning to have a very special guest that is as timely as any interview that I've ever done. I want to say good morning and welcome to Dr. Kazim Kazaronian. And I butchered his name. I'll let him explain it to you. He is a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Connecticut and served as dean of College of Engineering from 2012 to 2024. He is a member of the Free Iranian Scholars Network, a passionate advocate for democracy and human rights. Dr. Kazaronian is also an expert on Iran and the Middle East, particularly regarding the Iranian nuclear issue and human rights situation in Iran. He has contributed widely through scholarly articles, invited talks, and media interviews on regional affairs and the democratic movement in Iran. Nationally, he has held leadership roles with ASEE and ASME, Shaping Engineering Policy and Education. His honors include the ASME Mechanisms and Robotics Award, AIMBE Fellowship, and Introduction into the Connecticut Academy of Science and Engineering, and ASME Fellow. His research sparks kinetics, robotics, and biomechanics. He also authored over 160 scholarly works and co-founded AcademicKey.com and AcademicJournal.com, a professional platform and online journal for academics, and much, much more. It is with great excitement that I say good morning to you this morning, Doctor. How are you?
Good morning to you as well. It is a pleasure and honor to be on your program, and thank you so much for that humbling introduction.
And pronounce your name for us, please.
Kazim Kazaronian.
Kazaronian. All right. So let's get right at it. Let's talk a little bit about your background. You're from Iran. Let's talk about that.
Yes, I was born and raised in Iran, in southern Iran, Shiraz, Iran. Did my schooling, high school, and then beginning of the university there. I was in University of Shiraz. In 1976 through 78, and that is when the university shut down. It was in the middle of the revolution, and my wife and I, she was also an engineering student, left the country. Although we both participated in demonstrations against Shah's regime, but when the university shut down, we left the country.
So clearly you have, without question, an understanding and a interest in what's going on in your nation of birth.
Absolutely. I think the past 3 weeks have been really intense. We have seen hundreds of thousands of Iranians on the streets of Tehran fighting for democracy, fighting for freedom, fighting for a better world, fighting for a better life for themselves. At the same time, we have seen a brutal suppression by the regime's security forces and some of the proxies that the regime has imported from outside the country. I should say that this struggle is not a new thing for the Iranians, that the struggle for freedom, for democracy, has been going on in Iran for more than a century now, I would say 120 years, and definitely about 50 years of it under this brutal regime.
So historically, when we talk about this regime, you can go back to the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was basically run out of Iran and replaced by the Shah. What is that, 60 years ago now? Or it's been quite a while ago. And again, the Ayatollah who was run out and run into the mountains and was able to come back after the Shah was, the people rose up against the Shah, who was placed in that position by the United States government. They welcomed back the Ayatollah. So even during the time when they welcomed back Ayatollah Khomeini, the people were still uprising.
So I think it would be good to look at everything in the context of what happened in Iran in a more historical context. Iran is a very resource-rich country at a very important location for in the world. Now it controls the Gulf, the Persian Gulf. It is right in the middle of Middle East. And its neighbors are in the middle, in a region that has always been some center of some sort of a storm and a struggle. In about 1920s, Shah's father was put in place by British forces at the time. And then at the time that they found him not useful anymore, British and American forces replaced him with Shah. And that was in 1923, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And then Shah became a brutal dictator himself. And even when Iran had an opportunity for democracy and freedom under Prime Minister Mossadegh, some people may remember him.
Yes, and he was
the man of the year on Times. He was the person that nationalized Iranian oil. And it was basically the best Iran ever had and the region ever had for democracy. But he was then removed through a coup d'etat, which was backed by CIA and England through an operation which was called Ajax Operation. And at that time, and basically, Shah's brutal dictatorship became very naked in the sense that I remember when I was a student in Iranian universities, you would look around and you would see that security forces, which were called SAVAK security forces, would attack universities, take students away for the crime of having the wrong book or the wrong magazine, or they have said the wrong thing. And those students would never see them again. There were many intellectuals that were executed under Shah or exiled or imprisoned for life. And that created an intellectual vacuum. Shah basically neutralized a generation, or actually more than a generation, generations of intellectuals. It was impossible to find independent books. It was impossible to find, basically, to understand democracy, to understand the opposition groups. And it was in that vacuum that when people got really tired of Shah and there was those massive demonstrations, millions of people on the streets getting rid of Shah, Khomeini and the mullahs used that vacuum created by the brutal suppression of Shah to take power. And then within a year or two after revolution, the mullahs themselves showed the brutality that matched or even surpassed that of Shah's brutality. And therefore, the people of Iran has continued their struggle against the current regime for the last five decades.
So has there ever been a time in recent history when Iran was peace and tranquility inside of the nation and agreement with the citizens and the hierarchy?
Very brief periods yet. I would say that when Mossadegh was in power in probably 1951 to 1953, a couple of years of freedom and democracy. And those 2 years basically was the beginning and of creation of many, many different organizations, many different parties from various backgrounds, basically people, and that includes my parents. People were able to come out and say things and start learning things, but in 1953, that Ajax coup happened. It stopped it all. And then again, another very brief period after mullahs took over and Shah was toppled, probably about a year or two, we had a spring of freedom. We had people on the streets, university students, basically being able to organize, and labor was able to organize. We were practicing democracy, but then it only lasted less than 2 years.
So the mineral wealth of the nation of Iran, which is unbelievable and probably is, you know, in a higher echelon, especially with the oil reserves that they sit on, it's kind of hard for us here in this country. We don't know much about Iran. We've been led to believe that it's full of fanatics, and you know, and these are people who don't want peace. How true is that assumption?
So first, Iran, yes, is one of the richest countries in the world as far as the resources are concerned. Unfortunately, that wealth has never, at least, actually, I should say never, been used to make the life of people better. Under Shah, it was that wealth was being used by a very elite group in the society. I would see in the northern part, which was the more affluent parts of the cities, very palace-type houses. People lived in pure luxury. And then in the south parts of the cities, which were generally the poor side of cities, people would basically be homeless or no access to very, very few houses in the south had access to clean water, to health, to free education. So very, very different styles of living between the poor and rich, and the majority was poor. And under Khomeini's regime, that got a lot worse. So yes, Iran as a country is very rich, but that has never been distributed to people. But at the same time, people of Iran are not fanatic. People of Iran, we saw as soon as there was an opportunity in the last 3 weeks for people to be on the streets, they asked for freedom. They did not ask for the rest of the world or for any country to be wiped off the map. They did not ask to go to war with any country. They want freedom. They want the ability to vote. They want the ability to be able to talk, to organize, to practice their culture, to practice their own religion. And that is far, far apart from fanatism.
Nothing wanted to... go ahead, sir.
So, yes, basically Iranian people, and there are democratic organizations that represent the Iranians. Iranians want a secular, non-nuclear, democratic republic, one in which they can choose their own leaders, one in which they can live in peace with their neighbors.
Doctor, let me call you by your first name, Kazim, because I don't want to continue.
That would be wonderful. I appreciate that.
Yeah, to mispronounce your last name. If as an American citizen, I've read about Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq and other nations in the Middle East, and some of the things that you are talking about with Iran kind of happen in the other nations as well of the Middle East. Is it safe to say that?
Yes, as long as it is not used in a context that lesson, it's used elsewhere. So why fight this regime? Just get used to it.
Yes, sir. I don't mean it from that perspective. I just want because we're in a position and a place right now where there's a lot of things being tossed around in our nation, including military involvement. And I think before we even talk about any of those things, which I think is really crazy, that we had some background, some true background information from somebody such as yourself, who will give us as the American people a truthful iteration of what is exactly going on, how we got there, and you're doing a great job with it so far. Now, today, and the amount of people who have been slaughtered, who've been on the streets, and some say as much as 20,000, depending on who you are listening to. What are your thoughts about now these people are in the street? What brought them in the street this time around? Clearly, I would say that from my untrained and uneducated view of what I think it could be, and that's the fact that the price of oil has plummeted, which is, I guess, probably the number one exporting entity that Iran has. And the fact that recession and sanctions and all those different things have all come together in a perfect storm, and the Iranian people are struggling and suffering, and they don't want to take that anymore. Is any of that true?
So the uprising that we're talking about right now in the last 3 weeks is probably the sixth or seventh uprising, major uprising, because there's always an uprising. Any given day, there is something going on in some city in Iran. But this is the sixth or seventh major uprising in the past 10 years. And every one of them have had a different spark. This time around, let me go back to this. Massa's, which is it was referred to as Massa, the woman that was killed 4 years ago.
Yes, sir.
Because of her hijab or lack thereof, that sparked that uprising in 2022. That was a major uprising, again, millions of people on the streets. This time around, it started with the merchants of bazaar in Tehran going on a strike because of economic reason, because the subsidies were cut. And that within hours spread to all the cities. The major difference that this particular uprising has with previous six or seven is the organization. The organization and the speed in which the resistance units spread it to the rest of the country, and also the type of fighting on the streets. This time around, it was a lot more sophisticated. People got armed very fast, and they stood against IRGC longer and harder. So this was in many ways the elevation of the type of street fighting against the Revolutionary Guards, IRGC. You talked a little bit about economic factor that led to this. Yes, there has been sanctions. The sanctions has really never been fully implemented because there has been a lot of loopholes. There's always Chinese that actually deal with Iran. There are Russians. There are also black markets. And none of that has been implemented. None of the sanctions we are talking about have been implemented 100%. On the other hand, 60-65% of the economy of the country belongs and is controlled by the Revolutionary Guards. Oil industry is the major one that is controlled by them. Oil income does not go to people. It does not even trickle down to the economy. It is used by Revolutionary Guards and by the elite rulers, elite class of rulers, for two things. One is for three things, I should say. One is to expand their reach in the region, their proxies across the region, whether it is in Syria, in Lebanon, Hezbollah in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq. Iran has multiple army-type forces in Afghanistan, in Yemen, and in other parts of the world. They have been using it to expand their nuclear capabilities, and they have been actually using and stealing a lot of those riches transferring it to their private accounts in Canada, in Switzerland, in the rest of the world. So this would account for the large portion of the income that Iran gets from the oil, and a little bit of it maybe is trickled down to people. And the more the income has been, the more has gone to Revolutionary Guards, creating more suppression, creating a more suppressive financial systems on the people. 85% of the Iranians now live under poverty line. That is in Iran's standard. The poverty line is not a Western standard that I use here.
So if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Kazim. And I'm just going to use his first name because I can't pronounce his second name. He's a professor of mechanical engineering in the University of Connecticut and served as Dean of College of Engineering from 2012 to 2024. He is a member of the Free Iran Scholars Network, a passionate advocate for democracy and human rights. Dr. Kazim is also an expert on Iran and the Middle East, and this is one of the reasons that we have him on. I'm thankful that he's accepted the invitation. So, Doctor, let me ask you, because nationalization of the oil, I was under the assumption, and many of us in this nation, if you look at what used to be Libya, if you look at Venezuela, and you look at the nationalization of their oil, there was a time when through the nationalization, those particular nations, i.e. Libya and Venezuela, the people benefited through that. That's never been the case with the nationalization of the oil with Iran?
So nationalization basically on the paper means that oil belongs to the people.
Right.
But in reality, it basically, we are talking, when we talk about Iran, we're talking about one of the most corrupt regime in the world. We're talking about a regime. When you look at IRGC or the regime itself, it is way beyond ideological. It is corrupt. Now the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, control smuggling and distribution of drugs in Iran. Alcohol is supposedly forbidden in the country, but then the distribution of alcohol is controlled by Revolutionary Guards. The prostitution in the country, which is because of poverty, is widespread, is controlled by Revolutionary Guards. So we are talking about a regime that is that corrupt. When occasionally the regime basically arrests one of their own because of their internal problems, internal conflicts. And when and the numbers that you hear from them on how much they have stolen and smuggled out of the country is in billions. They are smuggling gold, Iranian reserves, truckloads at a time through Turkey or through the other borders. So this is basically, yes, although oil on the paper belongs to the people of Iran, it is distributed, it is controlled by Revolutionary Guards, and that money is really a very, very small portion of it is trickled down to people.
So let me ask you, Doctor, if, because it clearly seems to me that if this has been an ongoing issue and continues to be that, and the people rise up and the overthrow of the government, which has happened historically in Iran, who do you replace that with? I mean, do you, because right now, do you believe there's a hidden hand, i.e., the United States government and the government of Israel engaged, involved in trying to support the overthrow of the Iranian government? I mean, that's clearly kind of what they are saying, those who are in power in Iran.
So this is actually a wonderful question. This brings us to a very, very, on one hand, very simple and straightforward, on the other hand, a more complex terrain of what is going on. Iran has a democratic alternative. National Council of Resistance of Iran. The National Council of Resistance of Iran is led by Mrs. Maryam Rajavi. It has very clear plans on how to transition to a democratic country, how to transition to a secular democratic republic within 180 days. Those plans are spelled out. And there is what we refer to as the 10-point plan by articulated numerous times by Mrs. Maryam Rajavi. And that 10-point plan is basically, it calls for an Iran which is non-nuclear, an Iran which is democratic, an Iran which men and women are equal, an Iran in which there is no execution, an Iran in which every man and woman has one vote in choosing their government, and one that basically people can have freedom of religion, freedom of their own culture and practices. And this organization has been fighting the regime for the past 45, 47 years, 48 years. And about 120,000 members of it have been executed by this regime, yet they survive, they flourish, they continue. And they have been, just during the past year, about 4,000 European parliamentaries leaders have supported them in United States. And there have been multiple resolutions by majority of the House of Representatives, by many senators supporting them, including the latest one was Resolution 166, which was in their strong support. So yes, Iran has a democratic alternative. And what that democratic alternative is asking for is what we call option three. We are not asking for boots on the ground. We think it would be disastrous. We think that the United States, Israel, or any other country should stay out of Iran. We believe that any support and appeasement of a portion of the regime would not be acceptable, because this regime, there's basically no reformists, no moderates within this current regime in Iran. So basically, we say option three, the Iranians should achieve freedom by the people of Iran. This doesn't mean that we are not asking for international support. We are asking for international support in this framework that I'm going to articulate. We are asking for recognition of the right of people of Iran to resist. And that is an important principle. We are asking for the world to put IRGC, Revolutionary Guards, in the terrorist list. They are in terrorist list in the United States, but the United States needs to use its influence to make sure that Europe does the same. We are asking for a implementation of the sanctions totally. Don't create loopholes and backdoors for it, because loopholes and backdoors not only render the sanctions useless, but also only create a channel of money to be channeled to Revolutionary Guards, and that's it. So those are the type of supports that we are asking for. However, I also refer to the complexity. As we get closer to the overthrow of the Iranian regime, and we are getting very much closer, the Iranian regime is on its last legs, there are a lot of opportunistic forces that pop up. And one that we hear a lot about these days is Reza Pahlavi, the son of old Shah, who is striving to bring monarchy back to Iran. He goes around, he puts the flag of other countries around him, and he knocks on the doors of other countries, begging for them to attack Iran, begging for them to help put him in power. And those things are disastrous. And although there is a lot of foreign interest money behind him, but people need to know who he is and where he comes from.
So let me ask a couple questions. Are you advocating for a coup? Because coups are generally, bloody, and very few coups aren't bloody. So you're not advocating for a coup. You talked about, so where's the United Nations position in this? It's one thing to talk about America. America is one nation. Yes, it has power and influence. But what is the thoughts of the United Nations in dealing with this issue?
Every single year for the past close to 50 years, United Nations have issued resolution after resolution, basically condemning the violation of human rights in Iran. Generally, that is the limit of what United Nations...
Yeah, it doesn't have the power.
Because they lack the power. They can have some power. Occasionally, they have used it. There have been United Nations forces on the ground. But generally, they do not take positions on alternatives, and they do not take political positions.
So what role would you see the United States, what is the United States' role in moving this along the way? You talk about the Shah's relative, grandson, or whoever it was. The Shah, for those again who may not have known or forgotten, was the puppet that the United States put in place. So if you replace the regime, Khomeini, that's in power now, who is the United States looking to support in this? Because whatever the transition is going to be, it is clearly going to take some of the United States involvement, a pretty strong involvement, be it economic or some other method, in order to stabilize Iran, even if there's a new regime.
So obviously, United States, being the strongest country in the world, have a lot to say about what goes on in the world, and they can influence things. But what the Iranian resistance, what the National Council of Resistance of Iran is asking United States is that do not engineer an alternative for the Iranian people. let the Iranian people decide for themselves. And actually, some of the messaging that we have heard out of the White House of late, indicates that that might be the direction that, that the White House and the United States would take. Recognition of the right of people to resist, implement sanctions 100%, ban and restrict and sanction the Revolutionary Guards. And this is probably the limit of what you're asking United Nations. And if there is any help that the United States, and if there's any material help that can be given right now, is providing access to internet.
You know, if you talk about, and you spoke earlier about 67% or so, or somewhere in that figure, of the financial gains from the oil but goes to the guard, then how is it possible that Iran itself, the people of Iran, as we've looked at these numbers of people who have certainly lost their lives in just protesting, what are the possibilities of them somehow overtaking or overthrowing the regime that's in place now without any support?
So we're talking about a revolution and versus a coup d'etat that you mentioned. Coup d'etat is a change of government from above and from by a group of military people. But a revolution is a change. It might be bloody. Again, how it is happening and to what degree it's going to be bloody, it all depends on the Iranian regime. But it is a change by the people of Iran. We are looking to have a country that would completely eradicate not individuals, but as a system, Revolutionary Guards.
The Revolutionary Guard, very, very powerful entity that has, been in that position for half a century or more. And so that's not an easy undertaking if we just read some of the horrific, stories that have come out about the amount of people who've been executed, shot on the spot. In a brutal, brutal fashion, to send a message to those who are choosing to rise up that this is what the outcome is going to be. I mean, that is in itself just unconscionable, but, it's clearly a regime that feels threatened, and possibly intensify as long as these, protests. And now from some of the things I've been reading, especially with Al Jazeera, the fact that they have now opened up and allowed a little more internet information, a little more of this information to get out, we're starting to maybe get a little more control over the situation. Is any of that true?
All of that is true. You're absolutely right that they're very powerful. They're about a million strong. It is, when I say Revolutionary Guards, although the IRGC is referred to only one element of the military apparatus of the Iranian regime, there are multiple apparatus in parallel that are working again towards supporting the regime or part of the suppression apparatus of the regime. But let me give you a historic example. Shah's regime had a very strong army, one in which months before Shah was toppled, the American president came to Iran and called Shah and his regime and Iran then the island of stability. And within months, we saw that army collapsed.
Yes.
And so revolutions happen. Revolutions are possible. Revolutions are not easy. This one, the people of Iran and its legitimate resistance have been fighting for 50 years. When would it happen? I don't know. But I know that a number of factors have lined up. And therefore, the situations are becoming more conducive to a total regime change in Iran. These are basically economic situation that we talked about at length, but also Iran losing its proxy forces and proxy influence in the region. And they lost it in Syria, they lost it in Lebanon, they lost a good part of it in Palestine area, they have lost a good part of it in Afghanistan and Yemen, and also their forces in Iraq are under a lot of forces. That losing influence, the regime itself calls it the beginning of the falling, the beginning of the fall for the Iranian regime. Iran has lost its ability to negotiate, at least for now, on the nuclear stuff. And a lot of revolutionary guards, again, I refer to, these are not ideological forces. These are corrupt forces that are there for the money. And a lot of them are beginning to fear their lives. And there is every sign that as soon as there is the struggle gets harsher and harder, a lot of them would put the arms down and flee.
So Iran is the most powerful and prominent Muslim nation in the world. Is it safe to say that?
I would say at least one of them.
Yes. And so we're not talking about some small military group that is Iran. And, it clearly has had many fights and many wars in its history. And so what, as an American citizen, I'm an American. You're an American, but many of us in this nation, the last thing I think we're hearing conversations about our nation moving in from the president and others and making threats. How do the Americans, the Iranian citizens respond to America waving, their might? And talking about where we're coming. That's the last thing I would think that the Iranian people would want to hear.
So words of support are heartwarming. It gives hope to the Iranian people. When President of the United States talk, people in Iran listen. And we welcome those words of support. Attacking Iran, first of all, let's actually talk about the logistics of attacking Iran. I don't think the world is ready or United States is ready or willing or plans to send troops to Iran. So when they say attacking Iran, they're talking about bombardment.
Right.
Revolutionary Guards have probably hundreds, if not thousands, of bases in Iran. And which ones are they is exactly going to be bombarded?
Right.
With all the heads up, how you would imagine that they have contingency plans and they have removed their stuff from there and they're hiding elsewhere. So I don't think that attacks on Iran are going to be that impactful. And therefore, what do Iranians want, and what is it that I'm asking American citizens? Basically, please do not engineer an alternative from outside. Please trust the Iranian people and the resistance to plan their own future. But and if you want to support, and we hope that you do, render your support to them. I'm repeating myself. Recognize them. Recognize their right to resistance. Every one of your listeners here, I would beg them to go and learn more about the National Council of Resistance of Iran, about its leader, Mrs. Maryam Rajavi, about her 10-point plan for Iran, about the detailed plan for a transitional government that would lead to a Congress that is elected by the people, that would decide the constitution of Iran. At the same time, help us expose the smoke screens by the old monarch. And when we hear that Iranians want the old monarch back, don't believe it. Look deeper and look beyond that.
So let me then ask this question, because what does the future look like for Iran in the next 6 months? If you were able to look into a crystal ball in what is transpiring right now with the continued protests and the threats that the guard is not threats, but actually carrying out, what would you say the future looks like?
I wish I had that crystal ball that you're offering me. I would take it any second. But I can't predict when things would happen and how they would happen, but there are certain things that are at least more scientific to assume that they're going to happen. One is that we are going to see an elevation of the struggle of the people, the street fights, I should say, between people and revolutionary guards. I think that one that in which it would be less peaceful, because again, revolutionary guards would suppress it harshly, but people would adapt and people would actually find, and resistance units would find ways to fight that and evolve. This is basically the dynamic of the situation. We are going to see more clarity on the political scene, whether that is inside Iran or outside Iran. And it's undoubtedly going to have its slower moments and faster moments, but the struggle would move on. The regime's power would go down, accelerating so.
So a couple more questions. One, what do you want to say to the American people who have this conception of the Iranian people that clearly is not true, but you know people can only go by what they hear, and unless they choose to listen to a program like this one or do some research on their own. What would you say to the American people who have this concept of Iranians as if they're, again, people who just want confusion and don't want what everybody else wants, which is peace and contentment of mind and to be able to live their lives in a humanistic view?
Iranian people are peace-loving. They want peace. They want democracy for themselves. They want freedom. They love music as much as you do. They love poetry as much as you do. They love sports as much as you do. They're really good in playing soccer. They're really good in wrestling. And their footprints and fingerprints are all over civilization in the world. And I invite you to go to any hospital in the United States, and there are undoubtedly Iranian doctors, and get to know them. Go to any university close to you, and there are undoubtedly many professors there. There are so many engineers. There's more than a million of us here. Numbers may go up to 2 to 3 million Iranians in diaspora in the United States. Get to know them and talk to them. This is basically a representative of the culture. So Iranians, all Iranians are asking is an opportunity, a chance to live in peace, a chance to live in democracy, a chance to practice their own religion, a chance to practice their own culture, a chance to prosper.
You know, Dr. Kazim, I have been honored and privileged to have this conversation and dialogue with you. I think that it's critically important that vehicles like this and give credit to Civic Media, this outlet that has given me an opportunity to reach out to you and have this conversation, because we have just got to be willing to open our eyes and our ears and hear other people's perspectives on life. You know, I know many Iranians, like you said, good people. I know many Muslims, good people. Don't judge people predicated on what somebody else says. It's always better to judge them on what you see yourself. You've been you're just a great representative speaking on behalf of your people. And I'm really honored to have had you on.
The honor was all mine. I was privileged and delighted to be invited to your show.
And I tell you what, I'm going to reach back out to you, because this is, you know, we can't begin to really get into the depth of what is transpiring, but I look forward to having conversation and dialogue with you again soon.
So do I. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. May Allah bless you and your family and your community.
Same to you.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll talk soon.